Hello and welcome to episode number 30 of Inglourious Artist with me, Peter Holland. We're at 3-0, people, and today I'm talking to director, writer, producer for film and TV, Marcus Olsson, who has been working the last 20 years on TV shows and films out of his native Sweden. And back in 2000, he managed to get his film school graduation film to be Academy Award nominated. And back in the 90s, he was part of the Swedish sketch comedy team Varanteatern. We're going to be talking about all this and more. Here is my conversation with Marcus Olsson. This is a first, of course, not the first filmmaker we have, not the first director, not the first producer, but the first Academy Award nominee.
Yay!
Well, it's a big deal. We're going to get into that later, probably, but we can start with like your, yeah, a little bit about your background.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into doing film and TV and stuff like that?
How did I get in? Well,
because what I know, I mean, the first thing I know that you've been doing, which is also a big deal for Swedes, is that you're a part of Varanteatern.
Once
upon a time, and that's they're like comedy gods for us almost.
That's nice.
Modern classic sketch comedy group.
Well, I believe that. During the 90s, I mean, everybody that wanted to make films made theater, or specs, as we say in your university cities, as there were no technique to make films.
Oh yeah, I remember.
Yeah, so then in and we had our group, the Varanteatern, and we got a TV contract to make our first show. And
For national television.
Yeah, and that year, I mean, everything I felt like we were the coolest band in town. I mean, I believe we wanted to be rock stars, but as we there were only like one or two guys in the gang who knew how to play music, and the rest of us were just like idiots. And so we. Started this comedy group instead, and everything. I mean, it felt like we were the coolest cats in town.
You were probably.
Yeah, that year, and from just pure this energy of doing everything right, we got a contract, and for the national television, and the same spring. I applied for a film school in Stockholm, and out of the same energy, I managed to enter the school.
Mm.
And that was my beginning for a so-called film industry. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a kind of a big deal to be able to go to that school, the directing school in Sweden.
Totally.
It's so hard to get in.
Yeah, totally. And I remember that for the first interview, I was in the jury was Reine Brynolfsson, big Swedish actor.
Mm.
And I was so thrilled with him asking me questions about me. So I was just glad, and I thought to myself that as I won't be able to enter, they won't like me for one or another reason. So I will never meet them again. So I thought that, hey, I will tell them exactly everything they want to know. So I told them about my love life and etc. And
okay,
probably somewhere there they thought that this was a really interesting guy. And also the head teacher of the school, he loves Malmö FF.
Mm.
And one of the biggest players at that time comes from the same village as I, Bjärred, outside Lund, Malmö.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, and of course he asked me if I know him, and of course I said that, oh yeah, we go way back. So, and I mean, it's always like that, that there is something strange that outside of the main talks that make you be remembered.
Mm.
I feel more or less like every time something good happens, there is something like that that has occurred during the process.
Mm. Mm.
So if you only have a normal conversation, it won't happen.
All right. You need to get deep.
Yeah. Or like, for instance, I remember when we did casting for a crime show, and there was a pretty big actor coming in for the audition. And the first thing he told me was, I won't get the part.
Mm-hmm.
No, why not? I try to be nice.
Yeah, sure.
So, but we don't know each other, and we have nothing in common, and nothing. Why do you want me to be here at all? So, and he was quite provoking, and I believe that made him actually go pretty far in the process,
in the casting process. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Do you think that he kind of knew that it was a trick he had?
I don't know really, but he was quite, how do you say, blunt or frank.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, he could, I believe he could picture that we had a list of like 10 names and we wanted this kind of actor. And as he worked on the Dramaten in Stockholm,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was among the right ones.
Mm.
But also as he didn't know the producer and he didn't know me. So he thought that there must be some other dudes that I know better and I am more interested
of.
And absolutely, that was the case.
Mm. And that's probably the case in Sweden a lot of times, that people know people who know people. And that's
absolutely
how it works. Yeah. And
yeah.
He was that experienced that he knew that's the deal.
Yeah.
Okay, so he was almost defeated already.
More or less, but then again, because of that intro of his, I wanted to surprise him somehow.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good tip. I shall remember it.
Yeah.
Like, no, you're not gonna pick me.
Exactly.
Let's just move this on, please.
Yeah.
I have things to do and places to be. back to Vrantheatern. Because you were a part of the first season, right?
I was part of the first season as, I mean, all of the sketches, more or less, for the first season were already written. I was in the writing room with the other guys, and then the idea was that when we were to start shoot, I would come down and be part of some sketches. But then again, the film school took so much energy, and I was so away from the gang, so it felt better to not be part of it.
Okay.
At all, so I was part as some kind of director for the parts that was shot with a live audience. But then again, now when I try to remember it, I feel like, hey, I was just one in the gang, but I wasn't part of the actual work. I was just
you weren't one of the cast. And
No, that
was going to be my question. Like, how come you were like part of the writing process and the directing, but you weren't part of the actual group we saw?
No, exactly.
So it feels like Terry Gilliam.
Yeah. I feel like I'm the Terry Gilliam of Vrantheatern.
Yeah.
And then the other guys, they will probably say that I'm something else of the gang.
Okay.
But
asshole.
Yeah. Nevertheless, I'm very proud of it. And after that, when I've done some teaching at film schools, etc. In the beginning, I always thought that I would be boasting about Oscars or something. But in the end, the only thing the students want to hear about is Varanteater.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How did you come up with that idea of Kiss and Bajslovski? And I'm like, yeah. I don't know. That was the other guys.
Okay, sure. Yeah, but it is something special about that. Because I thought, since it happened in the late 90s, it was the perfect time for me because of the age I was in. I was like around 1920 when you guys were broadcasting your stuff. And, and that's perfect for that kind of humor. And because you were around that age as well and whatever. Yeah. But I went to film school just a couple of years ago, and guys who were like 20 years younger than me, they started quoting Varanteva. And I was like, how do you... Okay, so just keep living on YouTube and whatever. And
yeah, that's
just
true.
Gets passed down. Or maybe it's something about if you were 8 years old, you could still watch it and have fun with it. So
yeah, you could like it being 8 or 2 or... Some things are quite ridiculous and genius in their ridiculousness.
Yep.
And also some sketches I remember I didn't understand what was the fun about them.
No.
But then when we were doing it on stage, everybody was laughing.
Mm. The performance has made it funny, probably.
Possibly, and also we worked also as a kind of rock band. I mean, if you no comparisons, but as someone said, like the Beatles, they lasted for like 10 years, and without a doubt, it's only because they had so much success.
Mm.
And I believe that was the case with Varanteatern, and that eventually. They got a no from Swedish television for another season or something, and out of that, they didn't have enough energy to go for themselves.
No, and do something else. No.
Yeah. So, I mean, as long as there is, everything is going perfect, and then when something a small problem occurs, unless you don't have this. Big wind in your sails, it will eventually collapse.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And also, people get families, etc.
Exactly. Yeah. So enjoy it while it lasts. And But my girlfriend watches stuff on a weekly basis still.
Really?
Yeah. It's like a comfort thing for her.
Okay.
In the same way that maybe you just, I want to watch that Monty Python sketch, that classic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You throw a Varanteva sketch on.
What's her favorite?
Oh, I don't think we can pinpoint one favorite because she just loves it all. Like,
okay.
Oh, this is great. Oh, this is great. This is great. And it's constantly being quoted. Still.
Amazing.
2018-19, yeah. So yeah, it lives on.
Yeah.
So, okay, but you wanted to leave, or you left and you didn't do the second season because you became a director and you went to school.
Yeah, I was at film school for 3 years, and I was totally soaked up with trying to become director. So I didn't have the time to be with the others. And also, I mean, it was 600 kilometers between us.
Yeah.
So... No, instead I focused on trying to make films. And also, when you enter this film school, you don't want to be a complete failure.
Mm.
I mean, the film teacher, he has chosen 3 directors. So I felt a kind of obligation to do my very best.
Mm. Of course.
So, and that was hard years, but in the same time, it was very, I mean, the things I learned from school, I believe it would have taken me like 10 years without the school to learn.
Okay. Yeah. Would you say it would be the same thing today with the internet and YouTube and the riches of the information?
I don't really think so. I mean, there are youngsters who ask me, so do you think I should apply to this film school or that film school? And if you have if you wanted to be a musician, if you have people to play with, it's the same with filming. If you have some nice dudes to hang around and make films with, you don't need film school.
No, you have a phone and you have the internet.
Exactly.
And there are books and
I mean, in my days, you had to apply to, you had to get into film school to get hold of the technique. But today, film school is, it's about connections.
Yeah.
So if you
absolutely,
if you are able to enter a national film school, of course you should say yes, because there are so many talented people from the business passing by, and you get to know them in a easy way. But I always try to say to young people that, I mean, as long as you are like under 30 years old, you could almost phone anyone in Sweden and say, hello, I'm want to be a filmmaker. What should I do? And almost everyone will actually give you some advice. I mean, because I'm only happy to try to give advice. And also, as the business somehow works as, I mean, if Knut, 20 years, get his big success out of a film where he has asked me a question of advice, I will be very proud for him. And I will say that, hey, I helped Knut to make that film.
Yeah. Sure.
So there's no reason to not to ask people who are ahead of you in the, how do you say, in the hierarchy or something?
Yeah, in the business, yeah. But when you went to school for directing, that's what you wanted to be. You want to be a director because you already had been a bit of a writer and a bit of a director and stuff. And
yeah,
now you've been producing
as
well.
I've been theater directing, and I thought that I thought to myself that I would do both. But then after film school, it was more or less impossible to get into directing theater. Perhaps, I mean, it's all about contacts and so on. And I didn't know the right persons. And then I got a fantastic TV shows to direct. So I was all into that for some years instead.
Yeah. But what is your focus back then was directing, and it still is, I suppose. But you've been doing some writing and you're doing some producing. But what is, are those other things just for necessity, or is it, you know?
Well, I have a dream of being able to write, but then again, I don't, as someone said, to be able to write, you have to have leather in your ass. I mean, if I sit down to write, I mean, after 1 week, I'm fed up.
Okay.
So, I mean, you have to really push yourself and constantly keep on writing. But then again, after a week, I feel like, hey, I want to meet some people. I want to do something else or... so...
Yeah, it takes time.
And also, when writing for film, it's something completely different from writing fiction. I mean, writing for film is so much situations. So my greatest experiences with screenwriting has been together with a screenwriter, where we have been like, we are okay with the character, we agree on the main character, and from there we try to discuss, like, how do you say, the situations of this character to get to that point where we want him to come. And when you finally get the situations right, I mean, it takes like half a day for the writer to write the stuff down. Because it's situations. And the lines comes from the situations. Instead of starting with the dialogue. And from that also, I believe very much that writing for film is something very different from writing for theater or writing for novels.
Yes, it is. And it's most often very time-consuming, like you said. Unless for some people, like previous guest Antonio Tublin, who writes his scripts in 4 days. Okay, bastards. Some people. But that's not the... Yeah. Mm. But do you prefer to direct the things you've written yourself? And
Well, mostly I'm not the one who has written it. So I'm the director. But since like a couple of years, I've been mostly producing, actually.
Yeah.
As I've been producing Therese, my wife's, works. And that's also a very interesting process to be the producer, because when you are a director, you're pretty much focusing on one single story, and you try to get the themes as great as possible with all the choices you have to make. But when you're producing, it's a bit more diverse work. I mean, you have to find money, and you have to help the director, and you have to make all sorts of problem solving, which is mostly a very fun task.
Oh, it's a good thing you feel that way.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would be hell to do that kind of job, probably. And it's so hard to find producers.
Yeah, it is.
Is my experience.
Yeah.
Find good ones, at least.
Yeah, but it's very time-consuming. And the worst part of it is to, of course, to find the money. But then again, I try to be slightly hopeful that it will be easier and easier to actually find private money instead of only the, how do you say, the governmental money?
Subsidized money.
Because so far the Swedish film system is all into getting the money from the state.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, when I speak to other producers who are much more, how do you say, experienced than me, I try to ask them, and how do you do with private money? How do you get the private? And they're like, what?
It's not even on the map.
No. They don't try it at all. And to me, that's very much because they are so in the pond. So they don't have to look on for other places for the money.
They can just go ask for more money.
More or less. Yeah. So, but for me, who is not really accepted in the pond, I try to look all over the place and find some kind of money somewhere. And hopefully the next project will be with both private and
state funding.
State funding, yes.
All right, yeah. I think that's going to change in Sweden.
Yeah.
Especially when we're going to start more and more collaborations with international projects, I think. That's what I've heard.
Yes.
Like SF Studios, they announced that kind of thing a couple of years ago, I think.
Okay.
That's the goal, to make more internationally viable movies. And I also know filmmakers from, like, say, the States or whatever, who moved here for different reasons and still want to do their thing, and they're like, how can you work like this? We don't get it. It's,
no.
All the money just comes from one place, and it's like one person who decides who, okay, so that means that just one type of film can be made, and with one voice and one political slant and whatever. So
it's,
it can be very homogenized during a couple of years, and then maybe we'll switch, and that's kind of weird.
I mean, it's also the one thing now that when we have this project called Ashas Irfader, and I mean, to be able to, and the work with this project has made me, how to say, I start to look very much on other projects, how they sell their projects.
Mm.
And it's quite interesting because when I look at American projects, I mean, they are trying to make the best film possible.
Mm.
This is a film that will make all families in the world go to the cinema, etc.
Yeah, well, they want to get asses in seats at least.
Yeah, and then when I look at Swedish films or Swedish projects, they are not that boastful about themselves.
No.
But, or there's one company that is boasting a lot, and that's Platform with Ruben Östlund.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they don't claim to make the best film in the world. They claim to make the most important film in the world.
Mm.
And that's so true, because European films are mostly, European films tend to be important instead of
just cash
exciting.
Grabbing. Yeah. They're not just entertainment. They want to say something.
Yeah,
more,
because
maybe more.
Because of the state fundings.
Yeah. Mm.
So to get state fundings, you have to make something very important. So the people.
Oh yeah. Well, in the eyes of the people with the money, at least.
Exactly.
So maybe it can be important to you, but it's not their view. So
no. Yeah. So at this moment, I try to correct a project to become not just very exciting, but important as well.
Mm.
And it's a strange process.
Yeah, that's probably a very good mix to try both of those. Because otherwise, I mean, if you just want to do something that feels important to you, that might not be interesting to anybody else to watch, and vice versa.
Yeah.
You just don't want to just do the popcorn movie either.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, I'm thinking about that quite a lot, actually, that when it comes to my own taste in movies, what it really is that I like.
Yeah.
And it really is a balance, because when I watch the most just super digestible entertainment stuff that almost mindless. it's so uninteresting to me.
Yeah.
But I cannot see the most super pretentious movies either.
Can you say like five films that's on your top 10?
Maybe five. That's good, because it's always like 20 movies in my top 10, and they're all fighting for the.
But just mentions a few, so I get a glimpse of your world.
Well, I think when you're talking about like this this mix, I love the Coen brothers as a directing team, and they, I think they have like a good mix there. So I think in my top 10 we have probably two or three Coen brothers movies.
It's like Fargo and Big Lebowski,
maybe Oh Brother, and recently a couple of guys have shown up that I think can almost do no wrong. Denis Villeneuve is doing great sci-fi stuff.
Yeah, and is he the one with Arrival?
Yep. And he's doing Dune now, and I hope that's going to be great. What's the guy's name? He made Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri recently.
McCarthy.
Yeah. I think that's true. And he did, I think he's the guy who made In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. All great films, I think. And that's, you know, it's indie, but still, I think Quentin Tarantino, at least in the 90s, did great stuff.
Yeah.
And he tried to do it super, super entertaining, but there's still something else there.
Yeah.
But then I'm also a sci-fi and fantasy buff, so I love Star Wars movies and love The Matrix and the original Lord of the Rings films and if I look to the side, I have a bit of a Moulin Rouge poster, and I for some reason I really love Moulin Rouge.
Really? I've only seen it once, and I remembered it as I liked it, but it pretty much came and went to me. But I believe we are in the same spirit then. I suppose you also like Trainspotting.
Oh yeah, I do. Not as much as the biggest fans, probably, because
Michael Mann.
Not that much.
No.
No, and I think it's mostly because I just haven't gotten into him really.
Okay.
But no,
you've seen Heat and Insider.
I saw Heat when it came out, and I barely remember it now. I've seen the famous cafe scene several times because it's a great example of a good scene, of course. But no, he doesn't really stand out to me specifically. Okay. Actually, I love Terry Gilliam's quirkiness.
Okay, he's too quirky for me nowadays. Yeah. I'm too old for him or something. I don't know.
Okay, yeah. So there's a lot of stuff, but I can really appreciate Jim Jarmusch as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Has he come with something the last?
Patterson, I think, was the last thing he did.
Okay.
And I haven't seen it yet.
No.
And that's probably 2 years old now.
Okay.
I think. Yeah. But I think he's... Sometimes, I think a lot of people can think he's a bit too slow.
Yeah,
and in some movies I agree, but mostly I think he can do it in a really masterful way.
Was it he that made a film with this big black guy?
Ghost Dog.
Ghost Dog. Yeah,
yeah. It was Forrest Whitaker. He was big back then. Yeah,
I like that one.
Ghost Dog is brilliant. And recently, I think Only Lovers Left Alive is great.
Okay, I don't know that one.
Okay, it's about a couple of vampires.
Okay.
With Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's something about American indie people.
Yeah.
They appeal to me.
Yeah.
It seems, yeah.
I believe I have the same feelings for them as you do. But then again, now the last like 10 years, it's more or less all about series, but of course, I've seen Stranger Things and the big ones, but I've recently come to the point where I feel like I still love a good story well told over 90 to 100 minutes. Is much more rewarding to me.
Okay.
So, of course, it's nice to watch, like nowadays, we're watching, what's it called, Grace and Frankie, Netflix series with Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's absolutely stupid, but nice.
Great people.
Yeah.
But Lily Tomlin is a genius.
But then again, the other day, I found on Netflix the Apollo 13 movie. So yeah, that's one. I put it on play while I was doing my dishes, and I was hooked.
Yeah, that is great.
Oh wow! I mean, it's so well made.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the story is still compelling. I mean, and also my wife came into the kitchen. What are you looking at? And she was also hooked. But of course, she said pretty soon that that's one thing missing for this film to be really modern.
Okay.
And that's where are the ladies?
Of course, but it's also it tries to be historically accurate. So if the ladies weren't around because they weren't in the cockpit, sure.
Certainly, but if the story had been made today, they would probably have made some female character a bit more important.
Yeah, I was going to say, like First Man.
Yeah.
Now, last year, so they had a lot of focus on the wife.
Yeah.
So, of course. And No, but it is, I mean, Apollo 13, that's Ron Howard.
Yeah.
And he, like you said, is so well made because he's a director who can get things done.
Yeah.
It feels like. I mean, last year they got him to finish Solo, A Star Wars Story, when they kicked the other directors out, and it was like,
"That's true.
Yeah, we need somebody who's good and can get the job done." You know,
yeah,
and it's probably a perfect choice to get Ron Howard. Then, like, yep, he's going to do a good film, and he's done one of those masterclass courses, masterclass video courses.
Is it on YouTube or
no? Because you got to pay for those.
It's
quite expensive.
The ones you find on Facebook always.
A lot of ads. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're good with ads.
Is it called Masterclass?
Yeah, Masterclass. Ron Howard, he's just directing. And,
okay.
Yeah.
Have you tried any one of those?
I've looked at bits of some of them. I'm going to get into it because there are some good ones. I know there's a Dustin Hoffman one on acting. And,
okay.
So on. And there's a Kevin Spacey one, and it's not available anymore. Hey!
For some reason.
For some reason. Yep, and that got switched to somebody else.
Yeah.
Pretty early on, you made the film Major and Minor Miracles.
Yeah.
It was around the millennium.
That was my graduation film from film school.
Oh, and you managed to get that to become Academy Award nominated.
Yeah.
So how does that happen? I mean, for somebody who's listening to this and are, you know, filmmakers, and like, how do I go from this point to actually getting there? How do you get noticed by the Academy?
To apply with your short film, you have one way to get there is to win a short film competition somewhere whose winners are allowed to apply.
Okay.
And
that's like Cannes and
no, there
like
are like 60 or 70 festivals around the world, short film festivals.
Okay.
And
So it's not necessarily a bigger film festival that also have short films. So it's not necessarily Sundance or anything.
No. And if in my occasion, it was Uppsala Short Film Festival.
Okay.
And the thing with that was that the year where I won, they started with giving out a first prize, a second prize, a third prize.
Mm-hmm.
And my film was awarded the second prize.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was like, hey, woohoo, now I'm allowed to apply, yeehaw.
Yeah.
And the president of the Uppsala Short Film Festival told me that, sorry, it's only the winner who can, the first winner who can apply. Mm. So I was quite disappointed. And then, because in Stora Små Mirakel, Major and Minor Miracles, the main part is played by Brasse Brännström.
Okay, yeah, the famous Swede.
Yeah, and he was he himself was nominated for an Oscar for the writing of My Life as a Dog.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, sure.
And the fun thing he told us when we have the rap party was that My Life as a Dog was not the Swedish, the Swedish film of the year.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was not the Institute's Oscar.
Not their pick for the Oscars, no.
So, but for some reason, some American producer had seen the film and said, hey, it's a wonderful film.
Mm.
I would like to release it in America, but the only way to make a European film big in America is via the Oscars.
Mm.
I mean, if it's not on the Oscars, it's not interesting.
No.
So we have to try to make it come to the Oscars. And so why is this not the Swedish...
The Swedish pick for
the
Oscars,
the Swedish
at least.
Pick. Yeah. Well, we're sorry, it's not. Okay, but then the producer asked the team, the producer, this, the My Life as a Dog producer, okay, is there anyone in the team who has American connections? Well, the sound technicians, his cousins from America. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then we make it American film. We call it an American film.
Oh, okay.
So
if part of the team is.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So it's an American movie. And more or less, just out of it being an excellent movie, They sold it as an American movie, and it got nominated for Best Direction, Best Writing, and Best Something Else. Mm. And it was Lasse Hallström's ticket to Hollywood.
Mm. So weird that it can be counted as an American film,
because
it's still foreign language.
Yeah. Mm. Totally. And I mean, it was the same with the film Il Postino, if you remember that one, and other films as well. But then again, with that in my head, I just felt that I can't be picked as number two and being that close from being able to apply. Mm. So I yelled at the president of the Uppsala Short Film Festival, and eventually when she got tired of me, she said, like, hey, you can phone them yourself and ask them.
Mm.
Okay, so I got the number to the Academy, and I phoned them and said, hey, I'm a winner of Short Film Festival in Uppsala. Mm-hmm. I would like to apply. And, I mean, they didn't bother.
Okay.
So they just, yeah, sure, we send you an application form. So from that on, I just put it down, wrote the film, etc. And in those days, you had to send them a film copy.
Mm.
So it's not a VHS or DVD or something.
It was actually a reel of film.
Yeah. And if we were nominated, the Academy would keep the film.
Mm.
And it was the film school's film.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all fine with that.
Mm.
And I don't know how many films there were in competition that year. Perhaps 100 films.
Mm, yeah, probably.
But then I remember in December 99, someone told me that it was shortlisted.
Mm.
So, I mean, among the 10 last films. So then I was pretty nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's as we said, when the film was ready and done, we said that, hey, it's a film about religion. It has kids and animals and some slight humor in it.
Mm-hmm. Good mix.
Yeah, perhaps they don't like it in Sweden, but we believe it that in America they will like it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yep, they did.
Yeah, all right. How many could be nominated back then? Was it
five?
Five, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was one American film and one Danish, one German, one English, and our film.
Mm.
So that was pretty awesome.
Of course.
Yeah. And first I was like, I'm going to pretend I'm Bergman, so I'm not interested in these things. And
sure, you just phone them up and send it in. And
yeah, so I'm not interested. But then I was trying to make commercials for a company where the son of Max von Sydow also worked.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, boy, you better go.
Mm-hmm.
It's now or never. You're never going to get this chance again.
Mm.
So for fuck's sake, go. So I went there and I spent like 3 weeks in Hollywood. And it felt like having a birthday every day.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, yeah.
Oh.
It was a good event, I guess, as well.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was the year of Magnolia. And the big film that won more or less everything was American Beauty.
Yep. Yeah, that was a 99 film, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a really good year. I mean, 99 was a really good film year. So,
yeah.
Of course, the 2000 Oscars must have been amazing.
I think so, too. Yeah. I remember I called some other Swedish filmmakers who were nominated for Best Short Film the year before, and they were like, oh, this year is nothing interesting. When we were there, it was Saving Private Ryan, so it was Spielberg.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But hey, he was there anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Nova Wright, Magnolia. That's a great film.
That's a great film. And the Spike Jonze film, Being John Malkovich.
Yep, right.
So, an Insider, and
it was the year of The Matrix as well, but that's not a big Academy Award film.
No, I believe there were some technicians being nominated
probably for the bullet time effect and stuff. Yeah, maybe sound mixing and things.
Yeah. Mm.
Which short film won, beat you?
Luckily, the Danish film did not win. It was the American film that won.
Okay.
So, and I mean, afterwards, we who were the nominees, we had some dinner afterwards, and you had all the winners with their statues. And then I remember the short film winner, she was chatting with Warren Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
And you really felt like, okay, they already know everyone in Hollywood, so of course they know how to, yeah. I mean, I campaigned for it. Exactly. I didn't know anything about.
No.
The business.
No, you didn't have any company who could send out VHS copies and whatever. And
yeah, exactly. Smooch, nothing. You know.
That's a big thing.
And there was also the Cider House rules. So it was Lasse Hallström's big year.
Ah, mm-hmm.
And I remember Brasse Brännström coming over for the Oscars, mainly because he wanted to be with his best friend, Lasse.
Mm.
But afterwards he said that Lasse didn't have time for him.
No, okay. Yeah.
At all. He was so filled with meetings and stuff. So
that must be the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the awards as such is kind of, they're not fixed, but I mean that it's a special kind of closed off world. I still like the spectacle of it, and I watch it every year. I try to watch it live during the night as well.
Because
it's like 3 o'clock at night over here. I still like it, but you of course know that. There were great movies during the year that's not even mentioned because of some reason, because it's a genre film. And how often did a great horror movie get into the Academy Awards? Well, a few times, but not many.
Has it happened?
I'm thinking,
like a horror movie. Yep.
I just went. My mind just went to The Exorcist, but I'm not sure about if that was nominated for anything. It's The Shining, maybe. Yeah, that was probably nominated for a bunch of stuff.
Or at least Best Photo or something.
Yeah.
Isn't that the film where they used the Steadicam for the first time or something?
Oh, was it the first time? It was a Steadicam when they followed him around on the tricycle in the corridors. Yeah, it was. Huh. And there's a really strange fun fact about the footage for that movie as well. You know, the beginning when they follow the car, the aerial shots from a helicopter. The bits they didn't use went into Blade Runner's tacked-on ending, the happy ending in the theatrical release. They're like, we need some nice aerial shots for this happy ending. And you can ask him. He's got reels full of film from The Shining. Okay. And he said, as long as you don't use any of the frames I used, fine.
Okay. So, but is it an aerial shot with a yellow Volkswagen?
Oh, well, they have like aerial shots just of the mountains and things like that. So that's what they used. And it was the same kind of situation, you know, when Rachel and Deckard drive away in Blade Runner.
Okay.
But that ending hasn't been seen by my eyes for a long time because I've just seen the final cut or the director's cut for years now.
Ah, okay.
I saw the theatrical cut when I was like 13 or something. And I liked the ending back then, and I liked the voiceover back then because it made it more accessible to me as a 13-year-old, I think. But today, I was like, oh, no. That's so tacked on. And
okay, because I only seen one version. That's the... I believe it was a director's cut coming like 92 or something.
Yeah, I think the first director's cut came then, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
And there's no real happy ending there.
No, that's true.
Mm. It just ends with them leaving in the elevator.
Yeah.
After he knocks over the origami unicorn.
Yeah.
Mm. So, and I mean, funnily enough, your wife has also been nominated for a short film, right?
Yeah.
And that's and you're a creative team. That must be. I'm guessing if you look into it, it's probably not unique. But it's just the first thought you get is like, has that really happened? Like a married couple has been nominated with different projects at different times.
Yeah, that's very. I mean, I don't know about it, and but it's her graduation film got nominated for a student Oscar. So she did not go there, unfortunately.
Mm.
No, but also when we have hard times, we say to each other that, hey, if we have managed to do that, we must have something.
Yeah, I do that every day. Like, I managed to get into the things I've done, so I can do it again. Can't I?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there must be a third time for us.
Mm-hmm.
No, but and also when you when talking to private investors, it's quite nice to. I mean, for them, it's like, oh, so you've been to the Oscars? Okay, then you know your game.
Mm, yeah,
I don't have to question that.
Mm, mm.
That
must help
a bit.
Mm.
Of course. But yeah.
And you guys, you tried to get in there since then with Lost in Stongby.
Exactly, yeah. Because then afterwards I worked with a company in Denmark called M&M Productions.
Mm.
And they put into traffic
mm-hmm.
motion how to make a good short film.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you don't want to win a short film festival,
mm-hmm.
you can actually screen your film in Los Angeles County for 3 days in a row.
Okay.
In a professional way.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, the film is
viable.
Yeah.
Mm.
So we did that with Lost in Stongby.
All right.
And we thought that would cost like $10,000 or something.
Mm.
But it turned out it costed $400.
Oh, okay.
So
that's doable.
Exactly. So the thing with M&M Productions, I think that everyone in Denmark believes that it's very expensive to do it that way.
Mm.
But it's not.
Mm.
And
just rented like a local cinema to do that?
Yeah. So you look up an art house.
Mm.
And especially in September, because the deadline is late September.
Uh-huh, okay.
So in August, September, this art house cinema, they show every day lots of documentaries and short films, animated short films, all films by filmmakers who want their film to be eligible for the Oscars.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's perhaps not big business, but it's business.
Yeah.
For them.
Sure.
And when we screened our film, we were shown in the same block as I believe it was an Israeli film that eventually became nominated.
Yeah, okay.
And that year there were 140 short films in competition for like 10 shortlist spots.
Mm, mm.
And compare that with like the Cannes Festival, where there are like 1,000 or 10,000 films who all want to be elected for the short film program.
Mm.
I mean, of course, you have to know someone in Cannes to get your film elected.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or at least you have to be a very interesting name or something.
Mm, mm.
That's not the case with the Oscars. So
right.
for that reason, I believe that the short film Oscar is very democratic so far.
Yeah, yeah, in that way, yeah.
Yeah.
Is there an audience for those days when they show those blocks of
I don't know.
Films? Okay, you didn't get any like viewing figures.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But at least the guy at the cinema, he mailed and said that he loved the film.
Mm.
So at least he liked the film. And yeah, I don't know how close we were. I tried to phone and ask, but they don't give any ratings at all. So, but I would happily try to do it again. It's just that making a short film is just, of course, it's not as much making a feature film, but it's a lot of work. And you don't get paid anywhere.
Yeah.
Compared to a feature film that at least can be sold somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. And it can't have been super cheap either, since you had to have a train and stuff. And I guess that was costly.
That's true. We have a train, but and it would have cost like 4,000 euros to have it. But the guy at Skånetrafiken, the train company, he lived in Stångby. So he loved the title, Lost in Stångby. So he made the invoice disappear within their bureaucracy or something.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you just had to regard the rest of the train traffic and that was I'm in Lost in Stångby, I believe.
That's true.
I should be.
Yeah.
I was silly and agreed to when I was asked. Can you come and be an extra on this? Okay, so I should be a man on the train. I haven't seen it myself yet, so yeah.
Okay, but it's 20 nice minutes. I'm still proud of that. It's a fun movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fun premise, and yeah.
Yeah.
People should see it if they have the capacity to. I was thinking, I had a bit of an argument with a mutual colleague of ours about, especially when it comes to short films and beginning filmmakers. Like, I see so many projects being done by people who just want to make a film. And so they don't really reach a level of completion, you know. Really, this doesn't really feel like a proper film. This feels like a student film, or maybe something is brilliant because they are great cinematographers, but they don't have any idea about how to make a story or whatever. They just, I want to make a film because I want to be a filmmaker. I see that a lot. So, and that, you don't get anywhere by that. Nobody wants to see a film that doesn't feel complete, you know, if you know what I mean. And but if you do get to a level where you can win film festivals and even get to the Academy Awards, you need to have some kind of like focus and feel like, yeah, I'm going to make a proper film because that's my goal. And even maybe like you have it in the back of your mind that a film that is on a world-class level.
Yeah.
So, and my argument was that when you made your film that got you to the Academy Awards, like you had that mindset, like, I'm going to make a proper world-class film here, and that could win an Oscar maybe, and like that. But the other guys was like, no, that was a fluke.
Yeah.
That was probably just a bonus thing. He just made a film and then it happened to be good.
So. Yeah, I remember when we made that film, we had lot of discussions, me and the producer and the screenwriter. We did a lot of discussions on how to make the perfect 25-minute film. So, for instance, me, I was just as filled with Tarantino as everybody else those days.
Those days, yeah.
So, of course, I wanted to make a film with someone with a gun and a bag of drugs or something. But I pretty soon realized that to be able to tell that kind of story, you need like 90 minutes. To tell the story in a proper way, to make it believable, etc. So for that reason, we felt like I know nothing about drugs. So to be able to tell something in 25 minutes, no, it's not possible. So instead, we started to talk about other things. And out of pure luck, me and the screenwriter, we found a documentary about a priest who appeared to be very afraid of his clients. Because the documentary was about a priest up in northern Sweden. Mm-hmm. Where he sat in his car and drove to the homes of old ones. Mm. And in the car, he talked about Italian opera and talked about red wines and sang together with the opera. And it was, that he loved. But then when he met the old people, you could feel like he was afraid of meeting them.
Mm-hmm.
So, in short, it was a priest who didn't like his job.
All right, yeah.
And we found that very funny.
Yeah, it can be, yeah.
Yeah. So, out of that character, we started to construct a story. What's his total opponent? Well, that's a believing priest from the Vatican State. Mm. So, how do we get them together? Well, we have to claim something that's a reason for the Italian guy to come to Sweden. Mm-hmm. Okay, perhaps there's a miracle boy, yada yada. Mm. So it was very constructive, very... the story didn't come from any heart at all.
Okay.
So, but of course, I know about the Swedish...
The rural...
Yeah, the rural the Sweden, yeah. Yeah. I know the feeling about of that, so... Mm. From there came a kind of story that made sense in the end. But also I would like to say that that film was the first film I made that actually felt to myself as a film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because up to that film, I believe I've made at least 6 or 7 serious attempts to make the best film in the world. And they all failed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you did, there was serious attempts at least.
Yeah.
Because what I seem to see from some filmmakers that they don't really even, it's good enough because that's what we are right now. Like that, you know. I'm just like, why not try to make the best, like, world-class level thing you can. And
yeah. It's more or less just as hard to make a good film as to make a lousy film. Mm. So, sounds stupid, but it's better to try to work 10% more to make it
and actually do the sound mixing properly. That can be a big deal sometimes.
Yeah.
The last thing people think about, like, oh, yeah, okay, and then here's some sound.
Yeah.
No. It's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. But I saw that in when I went to film school, but it was for acting, for my case, because there was an acting film acting class. But when you see the film students, you can really see that progression through the different levels, because they were supposed to do... like a 3-minute film, and then was a 5-minute film, and then a 7, and then finally a 15-minute. It was just 1 year. Otherwise, it probably would end up in like a half-hour territory after a couple years. But when you got to the 15-minute graduation film, then you can see, okay, now we're getting somewhere. And it's nice to see
it
that
looks
projection.
Like a real proper film.
And up to that point, you could see that, okay, there's a vision here, but you fell short on a lot of technical things most often. Or they didn't even get finished because there was like, oh, we don't have that shot. Or, oh, that thing went wrong, so we can't really finish it, and then they just abandon it.
Oh.
Unfortunately, because sometimes it's like, but this was good, and I acted my heart out in it, if I was in it, you know. And, there must be so many unfinished films and scripts and songs and everything out there in the world, in people's drawers or on hard drives and whatever.
Yeah. And the thing with having a project that's not completed, I mean, you feel half in
I know, right? Yeah. I think I have probably 50 songs on my computer that I haven't released because I don't think they're good enough.
Oh.
and they're not finished. And I have some, you know, scripts being written, and I've got plenty of stuff that just hasn't been done yet.
So
It does something with your core being. You feel stretched, Bilbo says, like too little butter on too much bread. Thin, sort of stretched.
Oh, that is a horror.
Yeah, it's like a stress.
Yeah.
It's always bubbling underneath.
Yeah, I have some projects I would like to at least write to the end.
Mm.
So at least I have a proper draft of a script. So, but, well...
Yeah, that's so important, it seems. Just finish it.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be good.
Yeah.
Just get to the point where it's finished, and then you can do a second draft.
Exactly.
Tinker.
Exactly. And the second you have a first draft, it's much easier to make a second draft.
Mm.
So, I remember I saw the documentary about Kent,
mm-hmm.
the pop band.
Mm-hmm.
And Jocke Berg said that he was the one in the gang who tended to be able to finish things.
Mm.
And that's why he became the songwriter of the gang.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, the one who can finish things will rule, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah, at least have a leg up.
Mm. Yeah, instead of just being halfway through, it's... Yeah. Yeah, I can think of a thousand sayings on that issue. That you have to finish your stuff before you can say that you have actually made it.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, no, well.
Of course, yeah. And other things you got going on. You guys have this company, Tiny Lumberjack Film.
Yeah.
And that's fun because it's a film production company.
Yeah.
It's a cafe.
It was a cafe as
well.
It
was a cafe, okay.
Yeah.
And an event venue, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and now we're back to that word unique again. Could that probably be unique, that combination?
Perhaps. Well, the reason was that we found... a place that was so charming and with big windows to the street.
Mm.
So it felt like, first of all, we just wanted to have a small shop, like a museum shop,
mm-hmm.
Where people can buy things for the museum. And at our shop, they would be able to shop the DVD or the T-shirt for Lost in Stongby.
Mm.
But then, we started to sell coffee, and then we had a project called Eggs, Flowers, and Sugar,
mm-hmm.
Out of the ingredients of sugar cake, sugar plum.
Oh yeah, okay,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So we started to sell that cake as well, and then eventually people wanted other stuff, and I had time over, so I started to bake as well.
Mm.
Cinnamon buns and stuff. And the problem with having a cafe is that you have to if you have a good day with good buns,
mm-hmm.
you're not supposed to have a lesser good day the next day.
No.
You have to be on that level.
Yeah, because the regulars want to come and have their cinnamon bun the way they had last week. Yep.
So I had to make more and more. So now I can make cinnamon buns out of from heart. And but eventually I didn't have the time to...
Okay, so there's no cafe no longer.
No.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that was a cozy place. It's unfortunate, yeah. But you still have events, you have talks and stuff.
Exactly. So now we focus on having at least one talk a month where someone passionate about their topic come and just talk. And it tends to be crowded.
Mm.
There are only room for like 25 people, so yeah. it's not that hard to make it crowded.
No.
But then again, it has to be an interesting topic or an interesting person, because otherwise there will be like me and Therese's mothers only.
Yeah, but there's all, yeah, like you said, I mean, I've been there just once and that was crowded, so.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I guess.
What was that?
Oh, that was the actor guy in Lost in Zombie.
Ah, Figgen Noling, no?
No, no, no.
Bengt Seve Karlsson?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That was the one, because he's got an interesting career. It was nice to listen to.
Yeah, really.
Things I could relate to from his international experiences and things like that.
Yeah, he made it to Hollywood when he was like 60 years old.
Yep.
And so Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You've got lots of time.
Yeah. Well, I, at least I've been in a Hollywood-type situation. Yeah. But, yeah, and sometimes I say that to myself, like, yeah, it can happen to later than sooner sometimes, and I'm probably going to be established when I'm in my 60s. Yep.
Yeah.
Especially when I started so late, as late that as I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't become a pro until, I went to school and educated myself when I was 34, so...
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So my first pro gig in Snowpiercer was when I was 34, yeah.
Really? So what did you do during your 20s?
During my 20s, I did some acting, just as an amateur in the theater, local theater, and I did some video course and stuff like that, and then we did sketches and that. And then I became a photographer, so I was a still photographer at a local newspaper, and then I became a comic book artist. So I went to school for I went to the comic book art school for 2 years.
Wow.
And just before I did that, we had done a indie feature film that never got made. That was one of those
projects.
We don't have all the shots, so
no.
It never happened, you know. And
During those projects, I mean, when they are so stretched out and you tend to not like each other because of the film never getting ready. So it's a bad spiral downwards sometimes.
Yeah. There's another project like that happened a couple of years ago that hasn't really been done either. And it's too bad. Yeah. Because it's time you've spent and energy you've spent, and it's not really getting anywhere. Yeah. No, so I tried to be a comic book artist for a couple of years, and I totally like left acting and stuff behind.
Okay.
And during those years, and because of the paper and so, I've accumulated knowledge about graphic design. And that led to me getting a job as an art director, half of the marketing team at an NGO, a non-governmental organization, like a cultural diplomacy place. So I did graphic design and some music pedagogue stuff, and everything. We did a lot of stuff there and kept doing photography and everything, and just realized that I can't do this because this is not me. And people around me and myself were like, what happened to that acting thing?
So
that's when I decided to, okay, now I'm going to leave this job, just pack up and go somewhere where I can learn how to become a screen actor, because that's what I wanted to be. I never wanted to be on... I mean, I like to be on stage, do theater, but I that was never my goal, to be a Swedish theater actor. So I didn't want to go to our national acting school, because you learn to be a dramatic stage actor. You know, that was never. I'm a film buff, and I love screen acting, and especially international things. So I looked around. Okay, Prague has a film school with an acting class where you learn from really good professionals and working people in the business. And it's an American school and everything. And let's go. So
great.
I went there, and it led to me, being in my first pro gig, even before I left school. And which have led me to be like, yep, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And I've kept those sights since then.
Yeah.
And that was 7 years ago now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a detour. Now we went through all my stuff. We've done that on the podcast.
Okay, so the listeners like know bits. About you.
Yeah, well, this is as much as about me, me as it is the guests.
Absolutely.
Thinly veiled attempt to put myself out there. No. And what you got going now is that you're trying to get this new feature film done. Asha's Irrfader.
Yep. The Wanderings of Asha.
The Wanderings of Asha. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a nice title.
Yeah, so it's all set in Lund, and it's we like to think of it as some kind of intellectual comedy, romantic comedy, slash drama, and it's set in intellectual, that's the word?
Academic.
Academic, yeah, where people are, it's about people who have made their university studies.
Mm.
So it's not about the poor people in the suburbs who are dealing drugs.
No. Because it's set in Lund, and that's a university town.
Exactly.
You have a professor town and stuff like that in Lund. So.
Exactly. And it's about a young woman who has this life all set up when she one day meets Mr. Charming in the, how do you say, the laundry room.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this story between science and heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So, I believe it's a very nice story. We have gotten some development money from the Film Institute, which I realize is, well, it's very small money, but just to get the stamp from the Swedish Film Institute that they see something in it, it's very important for all the others, the other players who might put in some money.
And sentiment.
Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes I get the feeling that there is no one out there actually reading the script.
Uh-huh.
Except for the Swedish Film Institute.
Mm.
So they get paid to actually read stuff.
Yeah.
But all the others in this circus, they only ask, what does the Swedish Film Institute say?
Mm-hmm.
So, and from there on, it's not until the Swedish Film Institute says, hey, this is great, that they actually might read. So, and that's a pity, because if more people would actually read the scripts, actually more people would have their own opinions, which could be nice sometimes.
Yeah, and they might find that, hey, I want to see this be done and put that money in.
Yeah.
Because it might mean something specifically to them as well.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, so that's where you are with the Wanderings.
Yeah, that's where we are. And I'm now, the coming days, I'm going to Berlin to present it to some Swedish...
At Berlinale.
Yeah, decisions makers. And apart from that, that's the project right now. And hopefully we'll set it up during the year.
Yeah.
Oh.
And recently you did the web series Happy Street.
Yep, that was an interesting experiment with having no money from Stockholm at all.
Mm.
But I went to the scientific facilities in Lund and said, hey, what about a crime series on your ground?
Mm.
With very little money from you. Yeah, sure thing.
Okay.
So that was interesting. But then when it came to... We made 8 or 6 episodes. And from there, the story wasn't finished.
Mm.
So we would need at least 10 more episodes to be able to tell the story all together.
Mm.
But then because the first season or whatever you want to call it was so cheap. Everybody in the team did it very cheap.
So
when asked if we could do more episodes, everybody wanted some more money. So to be able to make six more episodes, I needed the double amount of money from the facilities. And that wasn't interesting for them.
No, I get that.
So as a producer, I then realized that to get the double money to do the same wasn't possible. Then it's better to get like the five times money to make something twice as big or something. So I tried to sell season two as a international cooperation together. So then the story would have traveled to Hamburg or somewhere else in Europe where there are other scientific facilities. So, but then I needed to get in touch with like German decision makers in the at the university spots, which was quite impossible because they were all like, "Why do you want to speak to me? You're into film. We are into atoms or something."
Let's make those
exactly
be friends. You can go to CERN or something.
Yeah.
Well, Happy Street is available for those who want to see it online.
So
that we must plug, of course. And it's a Swedish web series, but
It's subtitled in English.
Subtitled in English, yeah.
And it had some success in the English parts of Asia and and in the south of Sweden. No, but we tried to make ads on Facebook for the series. And of course, if you make an ad pinpointing at New York City or something, it's you don't have a chance.
No.
With all the bus going on there. But something in English that's directed towards like Cebu City on the Philippines, there they went like, "Hey, what's this?" So we got, loads of people from Cebu City and Bangalore.
Bangalore's a cool
that
town.
Was, I mean, it was like perhaps 100,000 who watched it from those regions. And I mean, as there are like a billion people there, it's they don't know. I mean, the people who watched it there don't know the other people there who watched our show. But That was a strange experience, anyway.
Yeah, that's a good tip, I guess.
Yeah.
Advertise your stuff in unconventional places, and it might actually take off.
Yeah,
where it can push through the noise.
Yeah, actually.
So, how will we find you? Otherwise, do you have any social media you want to plug or?
Well, of course, Tiny Lumberjack is on Instagram and Facebook, and Tiny, and I am on Twitter, but I'm not very, very active. I only retweet stuff, and
yeah, if you want to, if one want to find you, it's Tiny Lumberjack Films. That is
exactly the website tinylumberjack.se.
And they find you as a creative team.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you have coming up when it comes to events and stuff?
Right now, as I've been sick for a week, and I don't... I have not gotten any yes at the moment from people we want to come to our venue. Right now, there is unfortunately nothing. But soon enough, there will be stuff on our calendarium.
And don't you guys have a like a script writing course?
Yes, we have, but we don't have any courses planned
right now.
No, But possibly there will be something in April or May.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
We should have done this recording in front of a crowd, I realized, at your place.
Yeah, of course.
That would have been a thing, yeah. Oh, well, hindsight and all that. I might have your wife on as a guest as well. We've been talking about it, so let's see how we do that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. If you don't have anything else to add, I think we can round this off.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming. Yeah. It's been great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Wasn't that interesting? A lot of tips and tricks and interesting stories. And I also want to amend a couple of things. I mean, I can't believe that when we were talking about favorite films of mine that I didn't mention those late 70s, early 80s classics like Alien, Blade Runner, The Blues Brothers, and then quirky things like The Nightmare Before Christmas and Labyrinth and things like that. And when we were talking about indies, I failed to mention one of my favorite indie movies of all time, Smoke. Anywho. And I also want to amend that we were talking about Academy Award winners that are horror films, and we talked about The Exorcist, which actually, yes, it did win 2 Oscars for Best Adapted Screenplay and for Best Sound, and was nominated for a further bunch. And then we assumed The Shining would have been nominated and maybe won something. No! No nominations. It actually was nominated for 2 Razzie Awards, though, so there we go. Please check out next episode when my guest will be someone else. And until then, I hope you feel you have a birthday every day, if you would like that. See ya.